A 100 Years' War, the Duguesclin Period, the English-French Situation in 1369, Part 4. France in 1369 remained the varied patchwork of regions which it had always been, a country of many languages, disparate laws and cultures, and intense local patriotisms. In some ways, the French nation remained an official abstraction, familiar to the kings, their servants and propagandists, and a few churchmen. To most other people, the very word France meant no more than the Île-de-France, the region around Paris. With the accession of Charles V 5 years before, the monarchy had become once more an essentially Parisian power, as it had been in the days of Louis IX and Philip the Fair. The vast royal palace on the Île de la Cité, overshadowed by memories of the Revolution of 1358, was abandoned to lawyers and officials. The French war effort would be directed from the Hôtel Saint-Paul, a rambling mansion surrounded by gardens in eastern Paris, which Charles had rebuilt and extended during the 1360s. Charles's methods marked in many ways a return to the secretive policy of his grandfather Philip VI, who involved a small number of close relatives and trusted officers. His delicate health meant that he traveled little, never led his own armies, and had relatively short attention span when it came to public business. Meetings of his council began at about 9 a.m. and were generally over by 10. These habits would have counted as defects in another ruler. But they were compensated in Charles's case by an acute intelligence, an outstanding discernment and choice of subordinates, and a facility with public opinion which deserted him only in the final months of his reign. The French king was an enigma to the English, as he was to many of his subjects. John of Gaunt had once dismissed Charles as a lawyer, a remark which was not intended to be flattering and caused much amusement when it was repeated to him. Ostensibly, the French king's war aim was to enforce the confiscation of the English domains in France, which had been pronounced by his judges in June of 1369. What he really hoped to achieve is far less clear. For if the ultimate fate of England's French possessions has made their disappearance seem inevitable, Charles was a man of his time who did not necessarily see it that way. He certainly wished to reduce the extent of English holdings in western France, especially in Poitou, with its great open frontier to the Loire provinces, and its long-standing connections with the royal house, and in Artois, where Calais was a constant threat to the security of his realm. He never shifted from the demand that whatever territory the English king held in France should be held as a vassal of the French crown, and not, as the Treaty of Bretigny had laid down, as part of an autonomous state. But he did not wish to condemn France to generations of attrition with her closest and most powerful neighbor, and throughout his reign proved willing to make large concessions of territory for the sake of peace. Although virtually without military experience of his own, Charles took a personal interest in the prosecution of the war. Christian de Pizan called him principal captain of his armies, observing that wars were fought better by the power of the mind than by brute force of arms. The king made some serious mistakes, especially in the first year of the war, when he was too ambitious and hasty, but he learned quickly. Cunning, ruthless, highly intelligent, with the flexibility to respond to the changing military situation, he would not be rushed into decisions. He was very conscious of the military strength of England and a good deal of respect for Edward III, whose portrait stared at him from a four-leaf panel hanging in his study at the Hotel Saint-Paul. Charles appears to have been personally responsible for what remained the military orthodoxy of the next 40 years, that the English were not to be confronted in battle unless it was on overwhelmingly favorable terms. The policy was more or less forced on him by his country's failure to develop a strong indigenous tradition of military archery to match that of the English longbowmen. It remained an article of faith amongst his circle that Philip VI had gambled his crown by giving battle at Crecy, and was obvious that John II had done so at Poitiers. The king's defensive response to successive English invasions was to prove politically controversial, both among the nobility whose aggressive instincts had to be contained, and among the mass of ordinary Frenchmen who were obliged to flee to nearby refuges as the open country was systematically devastated by the enemy. But it ensured that the French were able to fight the kind of war in which they excelled, a war of sieges, surprises, and harassment, of persistent pressure on the marches which gradually wore the enemy down. A medieval ruler was expected to take counsel. It was what distinguished monarchies from despotism. Charles V's principal advisors were his immediate family, his brothers, the Duke of Anjou, Berry, and Burgundy, and his brother-in-law Louis, the Duke of Bourbon. These were the same men who had served as his lieutenants in the main theaters of the war and his executants of his decisions. With the possible exception of the Duc de Berry, they were all competent soldiers, skillful politicians, and diplomats, and at least while Charles V was alive, loyal pillars of revived monarchy. The most significant influence on the course of the war was undoubtedly Louis, the Duke of Anjou. This able and ambitious but impulsive 30-year-old, the second son of John II, had been royal lieutenant in Languedoc since 1364. He had been the most vigorous advocate of war with England before 1369, and he probably entertained more radical ambitions than the king for expelling the English from France. He was also well placed to realize them since his lieutenancy gave him vice-regal powers in all the provinces bordering on Aquitaine, from the Dordogne to the Pyrenees, together with the complete disposition of the crown's revenues there. However, as well as being the most formidable adversary of the English in France, Louis of Anjou was also a perennial source of instability at the heart of royal policy. His personal appanage was limited to small war-damaged duchy of Anjou on the Lower Loire, which brought a much less revenue than either of his younger brothers do from their great domains. Anjou was always looking for a stage on which to cut a bigger figure. He was also jealous, quarrelsome, and vindictive, allowing his actions to be influenced by personal vendettas with Charles of Navarre and Jean de Montfort, for example, which cut across royal policy towards these difficult but important vassals. Occasionally, he conducted what amounted to a foreign policy of his own with the English, the Castilians, and the Aragonese, and later, even the Italians. Beneath the royal princes, there was a large corps of ministers and administrators on which the king depended for the ordinary functioning of his government and increasingly for advice on major issues of policy. Over the years, its membership was remarkably stable. Almost all of them were men who had served Charles V's father in the last years of his reign. The Archbishop of Sens, Guillaume de Melun, was a soldier prelate who helped lead his retinue at the Battle of Poitiers and shared John II's captivity in England. He had sat on the French royal council since 1351. John, Count of Sèbruche, the butler of France, was another prisoner of Poitiers who had acquired great influence with the old king during their exile in England, and went on to serve Charles V's council and in a succession of delicate diplomatic missions. Jean de Dormans, who became Bishop of Beauvais and ultimately a cardinal, had lived through the crisis of 1356-58 with Charles when he was the Dauphin, and then served both John II and his son as Chancellor. Bureau de Riviere began his career at the Dauphin's squire and trencherman in 1358, when he must have been in his late teens, and held the king in his arms as he died 22 years later. This shadowy but influential individual became Charles V's principal chamberlain at about 1372, was virtually first minister at the end of the reign. Between them, these men brought a remarkable continuity to the conduct of affairs in France at a time when England was riven with political crisis and undermined by constant changes of personnel. Their personal options on policy are rarely recorded, but their experience of the long political crisis of the 1350s had made them share both the king's ambition to undo the effects of the defeat and his willingness to compromise with the enemy when the occasion arose. So we finally finished the section about what was going on between the English and the French governments. Next time, the war begins again. Now the sources for Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylund, The Hundred Years' War, Volume 3, House Divided, by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.